Check this out. A meat and potato pie attached to a weather balloon has been sent into space. That's right. The pioneering pastry, believed to be the first ever launched into the stratosphere, was just launched from the UK. Space enthusiasts have attached a camera and tracking equipment to monitor the pie's progress as it soars above the Earth's crust. I said it. I just had to. All right, I did. Check out the video right now over at coasttocoastam.com. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest tonight, Ralph Ellis. And we're discussing a little bit of alternative history here, but something that has been so well researched that we may have to take a second look at things. And next, we're going to tie Jesus to the Arthurian legends. Oh, yeah. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our guest, Ralph Ellis, will be right back. All right, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our guest tonight, Ralph Ellis. We're talking about the history of Jesus. We've moved things around 38 years. Now, don't get alarmed. You just need to listen to the research. And we're going to jump into King Arthur and that stuff. But I've got a couple of questions here from Twitter, Ralph, that I want to address really quick. This first one is from JD, which is, what is Mr. Ellis' research in the terms of the Isa narration with a Quran copper scroll and the Arabic Quranic story here? And I think you just posted something about that just recently that I had read, but there you go.
Sorry, about the copper scroll?
Yes.
The copper scroll, that was Robert Feather's book. He was trying to link the Jewish revolt with treasure that was left in Jerusalem, and he linked it back to Akhenaten, which I sort of do as well, because I link a lot of my research back to Akhenaten as well, because the Judaic God had he actually had four names, but two of the names of the Judaic God were Yahweh, which comes from the Egyptian Yah, the moon god,
right,
and Aten. And the Aten was the god of Akhenaten. So, yeah, I agree with Robert Feather on that one, that a lot of this is very closely linked to the Amarna period of Pharaoh Akhenaten.
And what about, the question constantly comes up. I did this with you the other day. Jesus of what? Jesus of Nazareth?
No, not really, because Nazareth didn't exist in that era. So Jesus was a Nazarene. This was a different sect of Judaism. There were about four or five sects at that time.
Right.
And he was a Nazarene Ebionite. And again, we even have that from the Talmud. The Talmud says that Jesus was a Nazarene. And he also says that Queen Helena was a Nazarene as well. And Queen Helena was the Queen of Edessa, going back to this monarchy from Edessa we were talking about in my book, Jesus, King of Edessa, because I identify him as the son of Queen Helena of Edessa, because these were a very, very influential royal family from northern Syria. They lived in Edessa. And they're even mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles, where he's called, his normal name is Abgarus. But in Acts of the Apostles, they call him Agabus. And Agabus was involved, and Queen Helena, she is well known for this, in sending famine relief down to Jerusalem in AD 47. I think they had a big famine. And they sent famine relief to help Jerusalem in AD 47. And this is what it actually says in Acts of the Apostles. And the interesting thing is that the money was taken from Edessa, from the Edessan royal family, down to Jerusalem by Saul and Barnabas. And so this story is intimately linked with the gospel story, because, you know, it's involving Saul and Barnabas, and they were actually up in Edessa taking this money down to Jerusalem. And yet still, the New Testament doesn't talk about them, and Josephus Flavius doesn't talk about them. They've been deleted from history.
Right. Right. Now, I think we've set the stage pretty solid for the life of Jesus and what was going on there. Let's jump over to the King Arthur side of things. And let's start simply from British history that we have. He is missing all the way up until the story started getting written, right? Until the 12th century, until 1200. There wasn't anything in the historical record about King Arthur before then, was there?
Yeah, that's right. There isn't. I came across this because in these books I was writing, King Jesus and Jesus King of Edessa, I keep coming across these little snippets that seem to be Arthurian. And so I thought I'd better go and research all of this and actually do a book on King Arthur. And that turned out to be the Grail Cipher, which was a real epic book. And I was very surprised when I first went into this because I didn't know much about Arthurian history at that time. And I went through all of the manuscripts. I've got dozens and dozens of them down here.
Right.
And yeah, none of these early manuscripts mention King Arthur. So we've got, you know, Gildas and Bede and Nennius. I mean, Gildas was actually supposedly living at the time of King Arthur. He was sort of 6th century. And he doesn't mention Arthur. Neither does Bede. Doesn't mention Arthur at all. Nennius only writes about a Dux Bellorum, a Duke of War.
Right.
He was called Arthur. But, I mean, that's not the Arthurian story at all. There's no Camelots, there's no Guinevere's and Lancelot's, and none of that story is there whatsoever. And even when we get into the 12th century, the all-important 12th century, Malmesbury doesn't mention the King Arthur story, and neither does Henry of Huntington, who both wrote very good histories of Britain at that time. And then suddenly, we come to 1135, so this is the beginning of the 12th century.
Everybody write that date down right there, 1135. This is very important.
Quite pivotal, yeah.
Right.
Geoffrey of Monmouth and Walter of Oxford suddenly get this new manuscript, which they said came out of Brittany, came out of northern France. And suddenly they write the entire Arthurian story, much as we know it today, just one or two characters missing. So suddenly this entire mythology suddenly blossoms in 1135 with Geoffrey Monmouth and Walter of Oxford. And you've got to start wondering, you know, where did this story come from? Why did it end up in northern France? Why did it suddenly arrive in 1135? Why did nobody mention this very influential king for like 600 years before the story was actually written? Well, the answer is going back to what we've just been talking about, because this era was the beginning of the Crusades. And the first Crusade was in 1096, wasn't it? Was Count Baldwin of Boulogne, who went out on the first Crusade. And off they went to the Near East to save the Christian Near East, because remember, all of the Near East and all of North Africa was all Christian. So all of Turkey, all of Syria and Jordan, that was all Christian land. They went to save the Christian Near East from Islam, much as your previous speaker was talking about.
Right.
Everything he said was true, because I've gone through the same research
right
for this book. But anyway, so off goes Count Baldwin of Boulogne, and he's heading out towards the east, and he comes to Antioch, and he doesn't turn right, you know, to go down the coast towards Jerusalem,
right,
as you would expect him to do.
Right.
He just carries straight on. So he carries straight on, and he goes across the Euphrates, and where does he go to? He goes to Edessa.
Edessa.
The very same city that we've just been talking about, which I had linked before I'd even started any of this Arthurian stuff. I'd already linked with Jesus, as Jesus has been one of the kings of Edessa.
Right.
And then suddenly I find that Count Baldwin of Boulogne goes on the first crusade. The first city they ever liberate from Muslim control was Edessa. So why did he go there? Well, I'm sure that he knew something about this story that I've been writing. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been there. He knew that there wasn't much point going down to Jerusalem to find any secrets because, well, Jerusalem had been destroyed after the Jewish revolt and after the second revolt they had in the second century as well, the Bar Kokhba revolt. So there wasn't going to be much in the way of secrets down in Jerusalem. Where you're going to find the secrets is over in the home city of Edessa, which was the home city of Jesus, King Jesus, which had not been destroyed at that time. Well, it had been occupied, I suppose, by the Muslims a bit, but it was still under Christian control at that time. So if you're going to find any secrets to the first century, that's where you're going to find them, and that's where they went.
Do you think a lot of it at that point was oral, or do you think that they were able to read about this or get it translated?
Oh, I'm sure it was written down. I mean, they wrote about everything, as I was saying before. You know, Josephus Flavius and all of the other historians of this era were all writing things down. So I'm sure they came across a manuscript. So two of the things that I think the Templars came away with from this little sortie were, one was the Holy Grail, which we'll probably talk about later. So they took the Holy Grail from Edessa because it was in Edessa.
That's right.
And two, I think they came across some sort of manuscript, and that manuscript would have been, it would have been a more sort of secular gospel. It would have been a gospel, but a more secular gospel, saying what happened during the Jewish revolt. It's something like the History of Kings by Justus of Tiberius, which is a text we know about, but of course it's not extant today, so we don't know what it said. So I think they found a very interesting manuscript, and they brought it back. And of course, Count Baldwin was a Count of Boulogne. So any of his courtiers or knights coming back to their hometown would have ended up in northern France.
Now let's talk about some dates here really quick. Obviously, 1135 is when the original complete Arthurian legend was released. That was 1135. But the trip into Edessa and the return trip back to France and Great Britain was when?
Yeah, well, Edessa was taken in 1098. The Knights Templar, who I think were critical in this, they were started in 1119, but they weren't ratified by the church until 1129. And then they had the authority to do this sort of work with this sort of material a bit more. So they had 6 years between 1129 to bring this manuscript back to northern France, because Count Baldwin came from northern France, and to start crafting what became Arthurian history. So what I'm saying here is that Arthurian history, it only blossomed at this time, because it was based on this manuscript that the Templars brought back from the Near East. And that the manuscript they brought back was a secular history of this King Jesus Manu, the King of Edessa, who is the biblical Jesus.
So let's put a couple of pieces together here before the break, which I find interesting. How many knights of the Round Table?
12.
How many disciples?
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah, coincidence?
This is exactly what Arthurian history says.
Right.
So Arthurian history, if you look into Merlin Grail, it says there were three tables were created. The first table was the table of the Last Supper, which was obviously Jesus and the 12 disciples. And based on that design, the second design was the table of Joseph of Arimathea, which was Joseph and his 12 disciples.
Right.
And the third table was the table of King Arthur, which was King Arthur and his 12 knights of the Round Table. So the Last Supper table was a round table, according to Arthurian history, and they were all based upon each other, and they were based upon the same symbolism. So the symbolism was the symbolism of the zodiac. So all of this, all of Arthurian history, in fact, all of New Testament history is based upon the zodiac. And listeners might not have known about this, but anyway, they've done the research in Judea and Jordan, and they found these ancient synagogues. And strangely enough, all of the ancient synagogues have a zodiac on the floor. because the primary symbol of Nazarene Judaism, this is the Church of Jesus and James,
right,
was the zodiac. And perhaps the best one, again, listeners can look it up on Google, if they go to the Hamat Tavera zodiac, which is on the Sea of Galilee. And it's a first century zodiac. I know in Wiki it'll say it's fourth century, but it's not. It's a first century zodiac on the Sea of Galilee, and it was from an ancient synagogue, and it belonged to Jesus of Gamala. And we know that because Josephus Flavius tells us so. So we actually know about this this particular zodiac because Josephus Flavius wrote about it, which is really good, so we know all about it. And that's where the round table came from. It was a zodiac. So the primary character, the Jesus character, or the Arthur character, actually sat in the center of the zodiac, not around the outside, in the very center. There was a hole in the center of the table. And they were the sun character, the Helios character. But the Helios character in a zodiac can also be the northern stars.
Right.
And the northern stars are the Great Bear. And the Great Bear is where we get the name from Arthur from, which is why Jesus and Arthur have the same name, because they were both the central component in the zodiac. And around the outside, of course, would be the 12 knights or the 12 disciples. And remember, all the disciples were armed because Jesus told them to go and buy swords, as it says in the Gospel of Matthew. So the knights and the disciples were all sitting around the outside, each allocated one particular sign of the zodiac. And that's where the Last Supper table came from. So all the representations we see in classical Renaissance paintings are all wrong. It was a round table.
Now, what about the knights themselves? Do they match up with the disciples? Do they all have a similar story that coincides with each other?
I'm sure they do. I haven't managed to link up all of them, but one of them we know is St. Peter. And St. Peter was Percival. And we know this because they have very similar histories and they did similar things, like they both tried to walk on water.
Which one was Judas?
One would have been Judas, of course, but I'm not entirely sure exactly which knight. I did identify him, yes. But the Peter one is interesting because Peter ends up as being the keeper of the Holy Grail because he's called Peter. Well, his name was Simon, of course. He was only given the title Peter, which means the stone, because he became the keeper of the Holy Grail. And Percival did exactly the same. He became the keeper of the Holy Grail in Arthurian history. And so we know that Percival and Peter were the same person.
Now, I know one of the things that you like to do or not do is connect your research with anybody else. You are completely independent of all of this. When it comes to the Holy Grail and some of the other popular stuff that has been discussed in the last 20 years, we don't need to go there. But for you, and we're going to pick this up after the break too as well, what was the Holy Grail, and did it make its way to Great Britain?
Yeah, the Holy Grail is very interesting because it's a central component of Arthurian history. It has three or four facets. So on the first level, it's just the dish, you know, it's the Grail cup, which took the blood of Jesus. And so it's connected with the blood of Jesus, it's connected with a bloodline, of course. On the second level, we get this wonderful scene in Arthurian history from Parsifal by Wolfram von Eschenbach, where the knights of the Round Table, because the knights of the Round Table are there to guard the Grail, that's their job, they are the guardians of the Grail, and the Grail comes out and it stands before Percival and Firefitz, who are two brothers, and Firefitz is being initiated into the mysteries of the Grail. And the Grail stands the princess stands before Firefitz.
Well, let me jump in right there. We need to take a break. And when we come back, we'll pick it up right there. Our guest tonight, Ralph Ellis. This is Coast to Coast. We'll be right back. Earth is due for an extinction level event from the sky. And even if we see it coming, we won't be able to do anything about it. And this is according to a NASA scientist who said this this past Monday. Dr. Joseph Knuth of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center said large asteroids and comets, the type that would wipe out civilization, are extremely rare but tend to hit us 50 to 60 million years apart. Given that a comet wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, he says we are slightly past due. Yeah, it's kind of doom and gloom. Is that fear? Fear stuff? I don't know. Check out the full article right now over at coasttocoastam.com. Just scroll down to In the News. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Ralph Ellis is our guest, talking about the history of Jesus. And now we're connecting the dots with King Arthur. And now we're into the Holy Grail. More with Ralph Ellis right after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're doing the history of Jesus with Ralph Ellis. The connections to the Arthurian legends, which surfaced in 1135. The Templars made it back from Jerusalem first time out in 1129. The connections to Edessa, of course, Jesus, King of Edessa, are there. And that's sort of the recap that we've got going on here. I know it's complex, but the research is solid and comprehensive. Our guest is Ralph Ellis. Now, Ralph, everybody wants to talk about the Holy Grail. And I understand that. It makes perfect sense. So that's where we are now in this part of your research. So let's pick up right there.
Yeah, on the Holy Grail and five. Oh, just before I do go on with that, I heard you mention the media impacts in your little entry there. I also wrote an article on the Carolina Bays. I don't know if listeners know, there are 500,000 impact craters all across America known as the Carolina Bays. And I wrote an article on that. And that's very interesting as well, why they happened. So, yeah, there are lots of things I actually write about.
Didn't you get that? That was published, right?
Yeah, that was in academia.edu.
Right.
And, it's why you've got this mass of impact craters all across America, which happened, I think, about 12,000 years ago. So that was an interesting event as well. So we're talking about the Holy Grail, and that's linked to this because we're going to be talking about meteors again. It's all interlinked. And we had Firefitz, who's the brother of Percival, and he's standing before the princess, and they are saying to him, "Can you see the Grail?" And Firefitz is looking, and he's looking, and he can't see the Grail anywhere. And he says to them, "I can't see the Grail. All I can see is this princess standing before me." And of course, all the other knights sort of fall about laughing, because the Grail is the princess. Because we are talking about bloodlines here, and the Grail princess holds the bloodline. So this is the second level of what the Holy Grail is. And on the third level, we now come to Wolfram von Eschenbach again in his Parsifal, which is a very good Arthurian history. And he says, and this is backed up by a lot of Renaissance imagery as well, that the Holy Grail was a meteor. And this was, he calls it the lapis elixir, I think. Anyway, whatever it's called.
Right.
It means the stone from heaven. And so essentially it's a meteor. And he says it was brought to Earth by aliens and given to a royal family to look after. And that is the Grail family. So this special meteor, this special stone, had a princess to look after it and a bloodline, and she held the bloodline of the family who looked after it. It had a round table of knights because the round table of knights protected it. And then it had a high priest, and the high priest were called the galley. And the high priest, the galley, that means the circle. In Aramaic. All of these words, this is another interesting thing. When you go through Arthurian history, it says in the Vulgate Cycle, which is this massive great tome of Arthurian history, it's about 3,500 pages long. And it says that all of the proper nouns within Arthurian history are Aramaic, nothing to do with Welsh. I mean, Wales and England and Britain don't come into this story for 99% of it. It's all Aramaic, as it says in the Vulgate cycle. And the galley means the circle, the
right.
galley high priest.
Right.
And they are the Galileans. This is where we get Jesus as being a Galilean from. This is the link back to the New Testament story as well. Jesus and Saul were both called Galileans, as well as being Nazarene. And it means a circle. Why does it mean a circle? Because it's based on the zodiac, and the main zodiac was in Galilee. It was on the Sea of Tiberias, just south of Tiberias, and it's known as the Hamat Tavira zodiac, the one we were just talking about. So the Galilee high priest were the priesthood who looked after this holy grail stone. And they had to be eunuchs. So they had to be castrated. That was one of the requirements. And again, this ties in with biblical history, with New Testament history, because Jesus said exactly the same. Jesus asked all of his disciples to become eunuchs. And again, listeners probably don't know about this because it's not preached from the pulpit, but Jesus said, and I'll give you a quote here because it's worth listening to. For there are some eunuchs which were born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men. But there are some eunuchs which have been made eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. That's Matthew 19:11. So Jesus was asking his disciples to become eunuchs, which, again, this is what I like about my research, because none of this makes sense. If you just read that as a gospel story, you think, what on earth? What on earth is that all about?
Right, right, right.
You cannot understand it unless you understand that the Galilee high priests had to be castrated, they had to be eunuchs, and that Jesus was a Galilean, so he was one of the high priests of the Holy Grail. He was a galley. And so he might well have been castrated himself in later life. I mean, he did have children. I think he had about four children at least. But in later life, he may well have been castrated himself when he became the galley high priest. And this was an essential part of first century history, because Josephus writes about it. And it was also a central part of gospel history. And so when we come to the players, so we've said here that the high priest of the Holy Grail, the Grail Stone, had to be a eunuch. And the Grail holder was St. Peter. That's why he was called Peter the Stone. He was called Peter Kiefer. And in Arthurian history, the same character, as I said before, was Percival. And we know it was Percival because Percival was tempted by the devil in the form of a woman, and to stop himself being taken by her charms, he castrated himself. So he became a eunuch. And within Arthurian history as well, the names are very fluid. Well, not fluid so much. A lot of the names are titles. And so one of his titles was the Galahad. So Sir Galahad and Sir Percival are the same person, because Galahad is his title, and it means the high priest of the galley. The galley had the high priest of the galley.
And then we have and Joseph of Arimathea and Josephus Flavius also come into this story together in a congruent sense. But when did the Arthurian legend complete itself, when all of the elements were there on both sides, the historic Jesus side and the Arthurian side?
Well, that's very interesting, because, of course, we're talking about Arthurian history, and Arthurian history is supposed to be a dark age, a tale about a dark age king in Britain. And yet most of these manuscripts don't talk about Britain at all. I mean, if you look at Parsifal by Wolfram von Eschenbach, it starts the story in Babylon, not in Britain at all. So the story starts in Babylon with Percival in Babylon. And his father used to work for a king of Babylon called the Baras. And who was the Baras? Well, he was King Agbaras of Edessa. We're coming back to Edessa again. So we're immediately back into Edessa and nothing to do with Britain at all. And then if we take stories like High History, which was one of the first of the manuscripts after Monmouth and Oxford, the next manuscript is High History. And High History, and also History of the Holy Grail from the Vulgate cycle, say that the original manuscript that Arthurian history was taken from was written by Josephus Flavius. And you've got to start wondering again, this is where none of this sort of makes sense. Unless you can tie it all together, you think, well, hey, what's all this about? And so you read some of the venerable Arthurian historians, like William Neitz, who's said to be the father of Arthurian history. And he says, it appears that Josephus Flavius was the primary author of the first manuscript. But of course, this cannot be true because he cannot be writing about Dark Age events.
That's right.
This must be a mistake.
That's right.
And I'm thinking, hold on, no, this is not a mistake. The mistake is to think that this is a Dark Age story. It's not a Dark Age story. It's a first century history, because if you go through the Vulgate cycle, I think, I don't know, maybe 50% of it is all about the history of Joseph of Arimathea.
That's right. And you're saying 50%, okay? I think you're being very conservative there.
Yeah, I think so.
But as you start to line it all up, the story is complete, and the stories are the same. It's fascinating. Oh, I wanted really quick here. This just came in from Teresa on Twitter, and I'm going to be kind here. She isn't the only person asking this question, and I was thinking it as I read it. So everybody is on the same page here. Were you describing the Muslim Black Stone in Mecca, you know, the famous space rock, when you were talking about the meteor? Is that what you were referring to?
No, because it was bigger than that. I mean, they do have a black stone, and it was reputed, I seem to remember somewhere in one of the books I read, that it might be pieces of the black stone. But remember, the one in Mecca, it's only about, it's about 6 inches high, and it's made of five pieces. It's not actually one stone. So that could be pieces from it, but it is not the stone. So the meteor stone that they venerated has a long and illustrious history. It started off in Egypt as the Benben stone. It was the stone that Jacob laid his head on, the pillow stone. It was the same stone, because that was said to be a little pyramid as well. Because this stone is a pyramid. It's sort of like, well, some of them are oval, but this one tends to be conical. In fact, if you want to know exactly what it looks like, I've put it on my Facebook site just this morning. I did notice that looking at the James Bond movie, Spectre, for some reason, and for nothing to do with the story in the James Bond movie,
right,
they have the Holy Grail in that film. So I didn't. If listeners can remember the film, James Bond goes on a train journey. He ends up in this like an impact crater in the middle of Africa somewhere. It was actually in Morocco, I think it was. And they go into a planetarium, and there it is. They stand before the Holy Grail.
Yeah, you sent me a picture of it, and I'd forgotten all about that until you sent me the picture. I was like, oh, man, Ralph is right. It was there.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it looks like, because we have images of it. I mean, this is not just a story from Wolfram von Eschenbach. We have pictures of this stone, because this stone made its way around various countries, and it ended up in Syria. It actually ended up in Edessa again. We're back to Edessa. But then it went from Edessa, it ended up in Homs and Hama, which is where they're fighting now, of course. And it ended up with a Syrian emperor of Rome, who, again, many people won't have heard of. His name was Elagabalus. And he was the high priest of the Elagabal. He was a galley high priest. It's exactly the same stone, and it's exactly the same position. And because he was the high priest of the Elagabal, he became a eunuch again. So he castrated himself. And this is one reason he was kicked out of Rome, actually. So anyway, he became the emperor of Rome, and he took this sacred stone to Rome. And because he did so, we now have Roman craftsmen making really good coins that depict the Holy Grail stone. And surprise, surprise, it looks exactly the same as the stone that they used in the James Bond movie, exactly the same. And we know this is the same stone that Wolfram von Eschenbach is talking about, because Wolfram von Eschenbach said it was intimately linked with the phoenix. And if you look at the stone of Emperor Elagabalus, it has the phoenix on it. And you've got to think to yourself, hold on a minute, Wolfram von Eschenbach would never have seen...
He wouldn't have known, right.
Yeah, he wouldn't have known. So how did he know this link? So he obviously has an independent tradition somewhere that said exactly what this stone was. So we can believe that what Wolfram said was actually correct, because what we know from the coinage means he was correct.
Now, let me jump in, because we're going to take a break here, and I'm watching the phones. We haven't even announced open lines yet for you, and the phone calls are coming in. That's going to be fantastic. But I want to address one thing before we get to phone calls and get to the break. This explains why there is no body of Arthur, no grave, no history, nothing there in Great Britain, yet there are those in Great Britain right now. Like I said, this is as heretical as anything that we could say about Jesus, too, as well. We're talking about King Arthur here, but it does fit the story, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. People don't like it because they've invested so much time and energy in their King Arthur, and they don't like losing their King Arthur as much as people don't like losing their spiritual Jesus.
It's
the same loss, you know. And, where were they buried? Well, actually, he might have been buried in Britain, because in my Jesus King of Edessa story and my King Jesus story, I say that Jesus was actually exiled to Britain, because we had this character on the cross that Josephus Flavius took down from the cross, as he says in his books, in his Vita, he calls it. And this leader of the Jewish revolt was then taken to Rome and exiled.
Right.
Now, where did they exile him to? So here you have the Romans. You've got this dangerous rebel who's called Jesus, the king of Edessa. Where do you exile this dangerous rebel from so he cannot cause any further problems? And the answer is as far from Judea as you possibly can. And as far from Judea in the first century was Britain. And at this time, by this same Emperor Vespasian, he built a very strange fortress on the western borders of the Roman Empire in Chester, in Britain. And this was a very strange fortress because it was the largest fortress in the Roman Empire. It was hidden away on the fringes of Wales. And it had a separate section in the middle of it, a separate encampment. And quite obviously, to me, this special fortress was a very large Guantanamo Bay, a first century Guantanamo Bay.
We've got to take a break right here, Ralph. Yeah. So let's do that. Our guest tonight, Ralph Ellis, we're talking about the history of Jesus, King Arthur. We got a little Holy Grail in, and next are your phone calls. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Stay with us.